So many cloud engineers that I've talked to over recent years are actually former network engineers who had to transition into a cloud networking role and add that skill to their repertoire, or maybe they're even still traditional network engineers but had to add that cloud networking function to their current job role. But what does that even mean? Is cloud networking really that different from traditional networking? In today's episode, my friend Charlie O'Riordan joins me to give us insights into how networking works in the cloud. We go over some considerations we have to make that may be a little different than on-prem networking. We talk about the efficacy of cloud-native versus third-party tools, and we even get some practical guidance on using Terraform for infrastructure automation. We're trying to bridge the gap between traditional networking practices and modern cloud methodologies here, so stick around. I'm Philip Gervasi, and this is Telemetry Now. Charlie, it's really great to have you on today. I've had the pleasure of meeting you several times at various networking user groups, mostly in the Northeast, where you and I both live. So it's really cool to have you on the podcast, talk about some cloud technology, some networking technology, all that kind of stuff. So thanks so much for joining me today.
Hey, my pleasure. Yeah, thanks for having me, Phil.
All right. So before we get started, why don't you give us a little bit of background? Now, I know who you are, and I know what you've been working on lately, but for our audience's sake, what's your professional experience? You could talk about personal stuff as well, of course. And sure. And especially like in your own personal journey from being very, very focused on, I guess you can call it more traditional networking, and now very, very much in cloud technology, which I know takes up the vast majority of your workday.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, Charlie O'Riordan, I've been doing this for a little over a decade now in the networking space. And I started off as a traditional, you know, route switch enterprise network engineer. I did that for about 5 or 6 years until I had moved into the data center fabric and data center connectivity and fabric space and got involved with things like VXLAN and EVPN, doing like large scale data center topologies. And I was sort of poached by a cloud vendor. At this point, I had dabbled in ExpressRoute and things like Direct Connect for some of the AWS and Azure basic cloud connectivity concepts. I had been poached by Microsoft and joined them as a consultant on their Azure Advanced Networking team, supporting much larger scale cloud deployments for a variety of customers in the commercial and federal space. And that sort of launched my pivot into cloud network engineering. I went on to work for a company called Aviatrix, who was doing multi-cloud networking, supported way more AWS. And at this point, I think I've done a lot more AWS networking than Azure, and a little bit of GCP here and there. And I just basically dove headfirst and hyper-focused on networking concepts and hybrid cloud connectivity, building those pathways between traditional enterprise and data center environments into modern cloud networking architectures and tying it all together for customers, all sorts of verticals, right?
Would you say that then the modern environment really is that hybrid approach? Because you did call one traditional and then cloud modern, and then tying it all together. So would you say moving forward, that is a modern network, right?
I think it is. I think what defines a modern network, you're really at the mercy of what your application developers and owners want to do. The people provisioning or designing or building applications for your enterprise. Ultimately where they want to host, you're sort of at the mercy of where they want to host those apps. And some environments are better for, other apps, right? Just depending on the platform and what you're trying to run. And for a long time, that was on-prem enterprise environments, and it still is for many applications and workloads. But now, we have a multitude of cloud providers that are offering specialized environments that are better for SQL or better for machine learning or just better for compute. Your application or your development teams have the choice to say, hey, we want to be able to deploy these apps in a scalable and agile way into this environment. And, depending on how you look at it, fortunately or unfortunately, network teams need to be able to support that connectivity, to avoid getting that finger pointed back at them as to why app teams can't deploy things where they want to deploy them, right?
Yeah, yeah. So really, I mean, your background is not necessarily, hey, I'm a cloud engineer, or hey, I'm a network engineer. You're a person who does focus very much on the network, but it's in the context of the modern network, which is part and parcel of the cloud and on-premises and the data center and all these things. And so it almost sounds like, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't want to put words in your mouth, to be a network engineer in 2024 and then into 2025, it really does mean having an understanding of, yeah, the foundational principles of networking, route switch, and how networking works in the cloud. That's just how it is.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's a really big part of it. And that's not true for all verticals. You know, depending on what type of environment or what type of service you're supporting, you may very much be an on-prem engineer, right? Supporting data centers, you know, co-locations, what have you. But for many of the sort of like mixed medium enterprises I'm seeing at the medium and large scale, you know, 9 times out of 10 now they have a cloud presence, and there is either a network engineering team that supports all of it or a dedicated cloud team, depending on the size, that may support the cloud components as well.
Yeah, for sure. And in my experience, you know, only the very, very largest organizations are going to have very hyper siloed teams like that, where it's just, I touch only the firewalls, but not only that, but only this vendor firewall. And we have a separate team for a different, like we have only the Cisco firewall team. And then we have the Palo Alto firewall team. Like, I've been in those kind of organizations that are that siloed. And sometimes for, you know, regulatory reason, and sometimes because that's just how big they are and they have specialists, you know. But in this case, I really do believe that, I don't know what the percentage you just said is, but the vast majority of organizations that are operating the things that we use day to day, so even at a very large scale, are not these gigantic organizations that are hyper siloed like that. I'm sure there's exceptions. We like to call them small and medium sized businesses, right? SMB. But I remember when I was like eyeball deep into Cisco certifications, you know, years and years ago, and you know, I'm reading a Cisco textbook, and then like in the textbook it would say like a medium sized organization with approximately 10,000 employees, and I'm like, that's a medium organization, like that's an SMB.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. I have worked in those kind of organizations, like a healthcare facility here in the Northeast where I live, with 12,000, 15,000 employees. And my goodness, there's a lot of overlap, and you don't have those silos. I think it's almost scary. Maybe this is not your experience, but it's almost scary that some of these, what I consider larger organizations, mission critical, like healthcare, have, you know, a scarcity of good engineers on staff and folks wearing so many hats. And so maybe that's just what the way it is across the board, but that's been my experience for sure.
No, I think that's especially true in government, public sector space as well. I'm finding more often than not in those environments, there's one person who manages, you know, an extensive infrastructure and has been for the past decade or two, right? And sometimes that's not entirely visible to the end customer who's contracting out those services to manage their network, and that just comes down with like with legacy support of an environment, right?
So you're currently, among other things, focused very much on multi-cloud connectivity, hybrid cloud connectivity. That's fine. And I do want to talk about the difference, some of the fundamental differences between the major clouds like AWS and Azure. But let's, prior to getting into that, what are some of the fundamental differences that you'd like to call out between networking on-prem, traditional networking, and networking in the cloud? I mean, I assume a lot of the principles, the constructs, the networking constructs, are they're the same.
You know, you'd think. At the end of the day, you know, taking Azure and AWS, which are the areas I operate in most often, right? These cloud providers, it's the same network you and I are used to under the hood. So the major cloud providers that I deal with, like AWS and Azure, under the hood, they're a regular network, but regular in the sense of what we're seeing in the large scale data center space. So these are multi-stage closed typically, which for anyone who's unfamiliar is like a 2 or 3 or 4 stage spine leaf topology, pretty much, where you can have spines, super spine layers, and you scale out from there. And these are highly efficient IP fabrics with, you know, massive backbones and global connectivity. And on top of that, they're running a tunneling mechanism. And in Azure's case, that's VXLAN, which is a MAC and IP in UDP encapsulation method. Man, that's a mouthful. And on the AWS side, it's Geneve, which is similar. It's also a UDP-based encapsulation method. And the nice thing about, you know, if you've ever worked with tunnels before, is tunnels are generally underlay agnostic. So what you end up with is a highly efficient IP backbone underneath, and then a tunneling protocol that provides the data, and then generally a control plane overlay on top of that. Now, the control plane part of that for AWS and Azure is this mess of extremely complex and diverse stacks of software that are operating this infrastructure. And they're controlling, you know, how these different tunnel endpoints talk to each other, and they're segmenting traffic based on these different tags and IDs. And they have, you know, different mechanisms of doing that. But at the end of the day, it's a giant data center underneath, just like the ones you might deploy at a smaller medium size if you were doing a spine leaf architecture for your environment on-prem, right? Now, the thing to understand as a network engineer coming into a multi-cloud environment or even just a single cloud and needing to build those initial connections is it's mainly done through the UI. Working in Azure or working in AWS, it's all software. It's all ClickOps. So even though it's a traditional network underneath, AWS and Azure have abstracted those concepts of networking so far away from what you're used to as maybe a Cisco or Arista network engineer on-prem, that it's going to look nothing like traditional networking. They have concepts of routers in the cloud, you know, AWS that's a transit gateway, and in Azure that could be an Azure route server, or it could be a VWAN hub in Azure, right, depending on your use case. The way it's implemented is wildly abstracted and very software based. So it's generally working with the cloud, coming from exclusively on-prem network engineering is incredibly overwhelming. You're still just providing point-to-point connectivity between devices on-prem and in the cloud. And within the cloud, the layer 2 and layer 3, you know, network forwarding operations are mostly the same, albeit with some key differences in Azure and AWS. But the idea that devices that are in the same subnet can talk to each other, and devices across subnets need to route to some gateway somewhere, those constructs are relatively the same in clouds with some small caveats here and there.
Right. And then, of course, the understanding that we consume these resources differently than we do on-prem. Though certainly in larger organizations that are cost conscious, they're going to look at cost per port and what are the least expensive transit paths and things like that. But when you're talking about cloud networking, and you mentioned transit gateways, you know, there's a formula on the AWS site about how, you know, they calculate my bill. Partly, you know, obviously there's other resources, but the networking piece on the egress that traverses that transit gateway, among other things as well. So there is there's traffic engineering that we're used to, right? From the traditional route and switch world, and then there's traffic engineering in the cloud that has a different dynamic, a different component to it. Trying to say, all right, what is my cheapest path? You know what? Now that I say this out loud, I guess in the service provider space, we also have that concept, right? We are looking for the cheaper transit paths, but that's certainly part of it. So,
understanding that AWS bill becomes a really core component of actually designing the infrastructure. Similar to when you're speccing out like a new DC or an office space, and you're tasked with putting a BOM together and researching the right equipment, making sure it's cost effective and it meets the needs of the business. You're going through that same process in the cloud, but it's done really every time you provision a resource. And it's tough when you're being asked to build some basic cloud connectivity with really no direction as to how much it's going to scale and how quickly. And normally that's the approach I see a lot of engineering teams are having to make. They're being asked to build some basic connectivity into the cloud because team A, B, or C wants to deploy an app and run it there, and it needs to talk to some database server on-prem, or they need to manage it privately, whatever the use case. And that's the immediate use case. And because cloud, you know, deploying in a cloud environment is so convenient and quick to do, we can kind of miss that step of building out an architecture that's going to be scalable, because it's just so easy to consume. It's so quick to deploy. You don't have to go through that whole process of a build of materials, of researching your equipment, of building out a network design. You could just click a few buttons and you could have a functioning network infrastructure isolated and available for you, the customer, in just a matter of minutes, right?
What are then the differences, not the differences, but like the use cases for someone that's preferring AWS over Azure or vice versa, or Google for that matter? I mean, I know most of your experience is in AWS and Azure, but why would somebody choose one cloud over another?
So
political reasons, I guess, right?
No, that's fair. Really, what I'm seeing is mostly application teams driving that. And it's been changing year by year, based on the services available in each cloud. And most of those go beyond what anyone would have to support, as a network engineer. But what you'll find is, or what I'm seeing at least, is I'm seeing application teams come to me or my team and say, hey, we want to deploy in AWS because they are offering this service. They're offering this private, SaaS solution in AWS or PaaS solution.
Okay.
That meets our needs. And sometimes that's some OpenAI based workload in Azure. Some SQL-based workload that operates particularly efficiently or is more cost-effective in Azure. Mm-hmm. And again, that's one of the huge benefits of having having such a widely available cloud platform, is you can look at a moment's glance and see and just make a decision which part of the world is this going to be, which part of the world and which cloud provider is this going to be cheapest to run. And you could make a decision that way. And a lot of the times that's just coming from the team who wants to deploy the application. So the fun of it is our job as engineers, we just kind of got to shut up and support it. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes or most of the time, but, that's from a cost perspective. Right. And then, looking at it from various geos and things like that, but from a networking perspective, are there factors to consider as far as performance? Obviously geos, you can start, factoring in latency because you have to go 1800 miles to get to whatever region or not. But isn't that part of it? I mean, you're going to the difference between AWS and Azure, how does network performance factor into it when you're designing both, connectivity to the cloud or perhaps hybrid or multi-cloud connectivity among those clouds?
Interesting question. I don't know that there's really, I haven't seen, a noticeable performance difference in the way network traffic flows between cloud, but I really don't have any telemetry data to back that up. I'm not quite sure.
Mm, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. As far as there's some substantial integration differences between how you do things like, like centralized security, for example, between AWS and Azure. But as far as actual network performance, it's really per region. And a lot of the times, especially as customers are deploying in co-locations, very commonly that have in the same meet me point as an Azure MSEE, right? They're Microsoft Edge, one of the Juniper device that sits in a cage in Equinix in a big co-location, and customers can request a cross connect into that cage, and that's how you provision the express route, right? Generally, those providers like AWS and Azure, they're all arriving in the same co-location, and you may very well have the same latency to each provider, just depending on which circuit you use, right? So sometimes it's all there, right in the same place.
But the underlying constructs in both AWS and Azure, focusing on those two, are similar enough. Granted, they're different, and there's going to be differences in perhaps the way that they abstract the underlying infrastructure. But certainly, they're going to perform in similar ways.
And from what I've seen,
at a similar service. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, though, that there are differences. I know from what I do for a living, there are differences in the information that you can get. Like, I know what an NSG flow log looks like versus a VPC flow log, and they're different. They're different things.
And the exposed APIs are like completely different between providers.
Exactly. So there are considerations then beyond just cost. There are considerations beyond just pure networking. What is your team already familiar with right now? And so what kind of data do you want to ingest from the public clouds? And frankly, a lot of the time it's lacking anyway, which kind of leads me into my next question about third-party tools, third-party approaches to not just to cloud networking, but into cloud management, into managing cost, managing visibility into things like that. I mean, there's a few different companies that you mentioned here in the show notes. So it kind of begs the question, what's lacking with inherently in the cloud native tools and services that they're offering?
Yeah, I think
don't hold back.
No, yeah, that's a big topic. I think the big one really that I hear every day is visibility. You don't own the underlying network infrastructure anymore. You can't span a port. There are some abstracted ways of doing that in Azure, for instance, where you can kind of mirror data off a particular NIC, but It's not what you're used to coming from an on-prem environment, right? Network visibility is the big thing, and mainly as a cloud network architecture grows, and you get to the point where you're saying, hey, we need to support this long term, and we need to build this to scale. And you're looking at your Azure environment, you're looking at your AWS environment. Generally, the model you go with is hubspoke. That's kind of it. You're tying these virtual cloud networks together. Every vendor has a different definition of what that is, but fundamentally, it's this bubble of address space that you're tying to another bubble of address space, similar to a hubspoke network and like an SD-WAN deployment. What you don't have inherently in the cloud is any device that's going to provide you, you know, per packet analytics or inspection or enforcement. You do have some controls at the network interface level, the virtual network interface level, I should say, in most cloud providers, where you can provide individual isolated security policies. But deploying those at scale is complicated. Managing those to be consistent across environments is complicated. Across cloud providers is complicated. So what normally I think the first direction folks go is trying to get some intelligent inspection capable device in the cloud. Generally, the idea is let's put a firewall VM somewhere in the mix here and make sure our traffic's going through a firewall, between different cloud environments or between different VNets or VPCs within the cloud, within AWS or Azure. Let's just redirect that traffic through a centralized appliance. Mm-hmm. So we can get all those, you know, nice visibility bells and whistles that we're used to and do that the packet inspection, what have you, right? And Azure and AWS both have different ways of doing that. Generally, it's pretty standard, like route redirection. You have traffic from, you know, one virtual cloud network that needs to reach another, and instead of going to the hub and the hub saying, okay, go to this other attachment here, there's some route in there in the mix that says, actually go to the firewall first, and the firewall inspects it, punts it back out the interface if it's approved, and it forwards onto its destination. And you may have that firewall behind the AWS or Azure equivalent of a load balancer, and you can have them in a scale set, and you can scale your firewall instances up horizontally. So great, you know, we can support a ton of traffic, and we can scale that out, you know, infinitely, right? To some extent, some limitation somewhere, probably 8 nodes or something. Mm-hmm. And that's great. That provides some central inspection. AWS, I actually learned as an aside, does a pretty cool thing with their firewall integration behind a load balancer. I mentioned earlier that each cloud platform has kind of a different idea of providing a tunneling mechanism as a data plane overlay. Azure, that's VXLAN. AWS, that's Genevieve. The VXLAN header is kind of dumb. It's really just, it's pretty locked in. It's just specified. There's some reserved bits, but it really just specifies a VNI, which is a virtual network identifier. Genevieve is kind of cool. Genevieve has TLVs, which, if you're not familiar, is a type length value. And it's a great way where between different platforms and vendors, you can kind of specify whatever you want. You can make packets do funny things that aren't normal. You know, mm-hmm. they can ignore routing and make these per packet decisions, right? Based on that Genevieve header being read by an appliance on the other side and being interpreted in some other way. And you can pack that right into the tunnel encapsulation, the Genevieve header. AWS uses Genevieve. So what happens when you have a centralized firewall in AWS and you put it behind a gateway load balancer is traffic will arrive at your gateway load balancer, potentially from an endpoint, and it'll get redirected from the front end of the load balancer to the back end, which is your firewall, maybe several firewalls, say 2 in this case. And it gets load shared to one particular firewall. Maybe it's pinned to an availability zone, which is this concept of an availability zone in Azure and AWS is really like an isolated data center. So it's the idea that if you have two virtual devices in the same availability zone, and there's a regional outage for that physical data center supporting that underlying infrastructure, because again, there's a real IP network under this, both those things in that same AZ availability zone could be impacted. So this idea that you'd put, you know, potentially one firewall in each availability zone. When the encapsulation happens, the Genevieve header is put on the packet at the gateway load balancer and gets sent to the firewall. These AWS, say a Palo Alto instance in AWS, it's smart enough to read and interpret that Genevieve header, and it will make sure that packet goes back out the same interface it's received on, so it can be returned right to the same load balancer or potentially the same load balancer endpoint if you're doing something funky with that. the way I came across this was trying to tell a firewall in AWS to, hey, behave differently. I want to receive traffic from my load balancer and I want to egress it out a different interface for a different use case. Mm-hmm. And you can put as many static routes as you want on that box, but it's not going to listen to you because it's interpreting a header. It's interpreting an IP, a Genève header that it's pulling off of the IP packet underneath. And you don't get a say in what happens,
right.
You know,
interesting.
It's happening before routing decision. So that's an example of some of the funkiness that happens behind the scenes in a cloud environment. And the results are you can't always do the same thing with your appliance that you would expect to based on your experience on-prem redirecting and routing traffic, you know, to different DMZs or what have you. So it may look similar, but it's there's some interesting characteristics that the cloud providers have put on that to make their software work in their environment with their networking constructs, right?
Right,
and
right.
That's just, yeah.
So you mentioned as far as some inherent limitations, you mentioned visibility. We didn't really get into that. When we can or not, it's up to you. And then, of course, you mentioned just now not the gotchas, but these I don't want to call them anomalies because they're very much part of the underlying infrastructure, but these differences in traditional networking, things that you would expect to happen, which don't because of the underlying Azure or AWS networking.
In the case
that you just mentioned, it was AWS. But what are some other areas that you would identify as inherent limitations? You know, I can see our outline. I can see a couple of them. And, you know, the first one I want to mention, I'm asking you, but I'm already answering you as well. Is as far as how you handle security in the public cloud.
Right. So yeah. Perfect segue. And thanks for reminding me because I'm forgetting where I am in reality right now. On that topic of what people are doing with centralized inspection and realizing they need a firewall and they want to see their traffic, that's kind of the on-prem network engineer brain approach to solving this problem in the cloud.
That's my approach.
And it's mine as well. And a lot of my customers are still asking for that. And that's a perfectly viable solution. And, you know, so anybody listening, don't listen to the vendors that are telling you, you can't or shouldn't do that. It's a good scalable solution. But there are always other approaches you can take. And there are some interesting things that other providers are offering that I think are really worth looking at. When really the big rush to cloud happened, probably what, like 6 or 7 years ago now, where cloud was kind of the hot shiny thing like AI is today. And everyone was, you know, at the leadership level was really being pressured to let's do something with this for our infrastructure, for our enterprise, for our product. A lot of vendors joined the mix and joined in the mix and really took a swing at providing like consistent and scalable network infrastructure across the cloud because the concepts were so wildly different between vendors and cloud platforms. So you had some weird ones. Like I remember Arista had this idea where they were going to do EVPN in the cloud. ACI has some similar product, Cisco's ACI solution, where they're like, yeah, you can go ahead and deploy these virtual appliances in the cloud and we'll manage them through the same ACI platform and you can encrypt and tunnel your traffic up. And again, these were all kind of like on-prem approaches to ACI. And you'll see some other on-prem approaches to cloud networking. And you'll see some other vendors sort of taking a different approach. Like Aviatrix was a company that I worked for a couple of years. And they took an approach to cloud networking where they wanted to provide a consistent framework that you could apply to multiple cloud platforms. So the idea was you spin up these virtual machines in every single virtual network or virtual private cloud or virtual cloud network,
okay.
You know, depending on Google, AWS, and Azure.
Yep.
And they build IPsec tunnels with each other. And then because traffic has to pass through multiple of these VMs and get encrypted and decapsulated, you have all that visibility back. Anytime any of your packets want to go somewhere, they go from the host in the VNet, say Azure, okay, for example, directly to an appliance. And then in that appliance, it gets tunneled across the Azure underlay. So your cloud overlay kind of becomes an underlay to another overlay and so on and so forth, right? You're further abstracting the cloud madness.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is a good approach if it's cost effective, because you're paying for these VMs and you're paying for more licenses. And the benefit to an approach like that, and another vendor that does it well is Alkira, and I've seen them in play a few times, and they have a very similar idea, is that by doing this and getting all this visibility back, you can do kind of two things. One, you can see all your traffic, which is great, good for telemetry, good for inspection. And two, because you already have the traffic going through, you know, basically next hopping to a VM anytime it needs to go anywhere, as close to the source as possible, you can apply inspection and policy directly at that first hop versus waiting for it to get to some centralized appliance in your hub VNet. And I think that's great because you can distribute your approach to firewalling, right? No longer are you having to pigeonhole everything into some centralized appliance and do this hub and spoke model. The cloud as a platform is wildly distributed. So the idea is this supports that model of something that's wildly distributed. And I think that's a good approach. But again, you have to weigh the cost and the licensing fees and everything else that comes along with locking yourself into another vendor. And but you'll see there are other players in the cloud space that are taking a swing at this to try to simplify that. And I think it's a good thing.
Okay. All right. So then, you mentioned visibility here, and that's not necessarily the primary concern of these security-focused vendors, but a side effect of being able to have all these packets traverse your devices that you have visibility into traffic.
You have all the data. Yeah, all the data.
Exactly.
Close to the host versus waiting for it to traverse the entire cloud backbone before you can do some inspection or collect some data on it, right?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we're focused on as a company, Akentic, is really the inherent weaknesses in cloud visibility, inherent weakness in the cloud native visibility tools. There are certainly some strengths, and a lot of folks are doing just fine, and I get it. But as soon as you go into a hybrid approach, into a multi-cloud environment, which a lot of people are without them even realizing it or planning for it, all of a sudden there's a merger or there's some new workload you need to spin up over there because of some bespoke service that's running, like you said, and all of a sudden, lo and behold, you have IPsec tunnels everywhere. You have a multi-cloud environment that is much more difficult to get a grasp of. Especially when you're trying to track application activity and then, match that with your AWS bill and why is my cost where it is. So
yeah, back billing is huge. I mean, we did that for years on-prem, right? And I feel like a lot of customers are finally getting to that place with a fabric where they can isolate out their network infrastructure, per customer and do that internal back billing and pull back that revenue for their networking teams. And now you're faced with that same problem all over again with Azure and AWS, where you're charged just sometimes flat egress, right? Mm-hmm. And that's for all your traffic. That's not for a particular customer and a particular VNet. So that is something I'm seeing as well with a lot of these kind of holistic like multi-cloud platforms is you'll hear like back billing support in a lot of their marketing data. And it's true. Having that visibility is huge. And when you're concerned about cost, being able to back bill some of that to other departments does help offset that and justify that purchase of that service for the networking team. And that is a win, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we do that with, adding custom tags in an enrichment process, basically just adding to the flow logs that we ingest and any other type of telemetry that we ingest that's relevant. And then being able to parse out different departments or business units or whatever, and usually the use case is chargeback, like you said. So, and it really is. It's just the propagation and the analysis after the fact, and being able to query on those custom tags.
Yeah. So absolutely.
Let's say here we are. I've been a network engineer for 10 years, 15 years, and whether I like it or not, I'm also managing some cloud environment. No, I'm not a cloud engineer. I have my foot in both camps, which is, again, like we started out our podcast today, probably a very common scenario for a lot of engineers. What are some tools, or if there's one particular tool that you want to talk about that will allow me to programmatically manage cloud environments, that will allow me to also manage in the same tool my on-prem environments and get a handle of all of that without having to manage multiple?
Yeah, I think I'll say this coming from the perspective of someone who started his journey in network engineering because I tried software development and hated it, which I think is a really common theme with a lot of network engineers I've talked to. Right? It's like, oh man, I'm doing this JavaScript class, and I'm just having the worst time, worst time ever. But routers seem cool, right? I really never wanted to do any programming, and with the advent of cloud and folks needing to find a way to automate that consistently, I didn't really have a choice. So eventually I got pulled into the Terraform world. And this was around the time I was with, Aviatrix and Microsoft and having to support these larger topologies, right? A lot of the customers were already managing their environments with Terraform. And what Terraform is it's kind of like it's kind of like automate. It's kind of like the easy button for automation, I think. And you could take it as far as you want to go. So I've seen Terraform deployments that are plain text, simple. And I've seen Terraform deployments that are incredibly complex. And both of them accomplish the same exact task with varying degrees of efficiency, which is great for someone like me who's trying to come in and doesn't want to learn. I don't want to be a Python expert. And mm-hmm. I never did a lot of object-oriented programming. And it's not something I particularly enjoy. So if you're like me, I think Terraform is a great place to start. The reason is it's basically a plain text language where you're defining the resources you want to provision. And all these big vendors like AWS and Azure, what they're doing is they have these Terraform provider registries that are publicly available on the internet, where they write up their own Terraform code. What it is underneath is it's really just Golang looping through a bunch of API calls. So like Golang's kind of like a Python alternative, as I understand it, as again, like a non-software engineer. Mm-hmm. And what it's doing is it's just looping through a bunch of API calls in an intelligent way. So by the time you're writing Terraform code and you say, you know, resource VPC, you're deploying something in AWS, it's as simple as just saying that you want a VPC, defining, you know, the CIDR for that VPC, the address space for it, maybe some tags, a couple other required characteristics, and then, you know, seven other optional fields that you can define if you want them. You click go, as long as you have access to the API and you have the keys to manage your environment, that resource gets deployed. And you can list out every single resource in a one-by-one fashion and deploy an entire cloud infrastructure, your entire cloud infrastructure that way. You can also get very detailed with your Terraform deployment. You can start creating modules. You can start writing looping mechanisms that will, mm-hmm. you know, deploy multiple instances of the same resource over and over again with varying IDs and inputs. And you can start, you know, creating variables for all these objects, and you could just keep running with it that way. You could do ternary expressions, right? You could feed in Python. There's ways to, you know, attach other bits of code into your Terraform if you want to do something a little more complex, if you need to maybe loop through some API calls that aren't available in the provider registry. Or like I said, you could just flat out list out plain text English, a bunch of resources that you want deployed. And what Terraform allows you to do is it's this this concept I was introduced to called idempotency. It's the idea that you can deploy your infrastructure, and if you attempt to deploy it again and there haven't been any changes in the code base, nothing will change. So it won't try to redeploy your infrastructure.
Right. Yeah.
In the sense of a network engineer, it's stateful versus stateless, right? You're aware of an active session. That's kind of the concept, but it's the programmatic version of that. Mm-hmm. Right. So you can deploy your infra, and if you haven't made any changes and you click the deploy button again, unless someone went in and made changes outside of the code base, it will not change anything. Nothing will get redeployed. There will be zero changes, and it allows you to visualize those changes before you push it out too. So if you make a couple changes, maybe you change some tags on a VPC, maybe you add an additional peering between VPCs, something like that. And you go in, you can do a Terraform plan, and it will spit out exactly, hey, based on how your infrastructure is currently deployed, this is Terraform talking to you. This is what I think is going to change, or this is what I know is going to change, right? And you could review that, make sure it makes sense, and then you can apply that configuration, and it will make exactly those changes and nothing else. And the same thing with deleting and removing resources as well. So you're able to maintain this very stateful environment where it's extremely efficient. It's a very like risk adverse approach to managing infrastructure that allows you to preview everything you do before you make changes, mm-hmm. because it's just so easy to botch infrastructure in the cloud with a click of the button, with how wildly complex and sometimes poorly documented these vendors like Azure and AWS make their gear, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And on-prem for that matter.
Yeah. And on-prem. Absolutely.
I mean, and that actually, for me, it begs the question that if I'm using Terraform to more programmatically manage my cloud environment, can I use that in any way, shape or form for on-prem?
It's a good question. And I think all of us have that, like, that burning that I think all of us have a desire to manage as much of our infrastructure as possible through a single point, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean.
Ideally, less tools, better, right? Mm-hmm. The downside to Terraform is I don't see a ton of on-prem infrastructure support. Mm. And what you can do if you have a particular platform in mind that you're interested in managing with Terraform, You can go on the Terraform provider registry and you could search for that vendor. And you could just kind of take a look at the available code base there and see if it's something that's pretty well thought out, if it looks, you know, reasonably maintained. It's really kind of this optional thing that vendors can do. They need to dedicate engineering time to turning all this Golang script into Terraform code and then publishing it and maintaining it every time they update something.
Yeah.
And that's that is absolutely something the cloud providers do. I don't see that as much on-prem, but you will occasionally see providers like Cisco ACI as a Terraform provider. I'm not sure that I would want to use that 100% of the time.
Okay.
I've seen some SD-WAN vendors like VeloCloud is a VMware's SD-WAN product. They're a Terraform provider, but it's like there's like four resources in there, and I think it's just for initially deploying maybe the first controller and nothing else, not actually making changes to your environment. And some of the vendors that already have like some centralized manager appliance, what I've noticed is you won't really see them write Terraform code for that because they want you to actually log into their appliance and manage things that way. The workaround for that is really, like I said, under the hood, Terraform is just stringing together in a complex way a bunch of API calls. What you can do and what most vendors do have are a published list of APIs that are available. So if you have a particular use case you want to do on-prem, you're getting comfortable with Terraform and the idea of working with an API, what I would suggest is take a look at the API documentation for that particular product or provider. What you may find is that is very well thought out and published, and that's been my experience as well. And you could write a pretty straightforward script that just loops together a couple of particular posts or get messages and accomplishes some operational task that you want to do. Maybe it's changing a switch port, right? And I think that's the right way to get started with automation if you're not coming from a software engineering background.
Yeah.
Terraform has been such a great introduction into that world for me that I think got me over the hump of like, this stuff is scary and I don't want to deal with it. They do really make it very simple in the cloud. And it's the big hurdle for me was learning how to work with Git for the first time and understanding how to generate keys so I can log into the right environments. Like that operational headache, that was the hard part. Actually writing stuff with Terraform, it's so well documented for the cloud providers. And if you have an opportunity to do some small version of that in your environment, I would recommend everyone give it a shot.
Yeah, especially for network engineers that are now embracing network automation. I mean, it goes without saying that you want to apply some of those same skills and mindset to what you're doing in the cloud, considering that many of us do have a foot in both of those camps now, traditional networking and in cloud networking, so whether we like it or not. So, Charlie, before we close out, are there any recommendations that you would like to or could give to more traditional network engineers that find themselves now working in the cloud world as well that they can do to increase their chances of success as they kind of straddle both camps?
Yeah, I would say in AWS and Azure's case, take a look at some of the well-architected frameworks that they have available. There are some really good starting topologies that you can work with to deploy a simple cloud environment. And don't be afraid to push back on people who just want to throw money at the problem. You don't always need an express route or direct connect circuit. You don't need a 10 gigabit circuit into the cloud. And what I would suggest is avoid making the mistake of treating the cloud like an extension of your data center. It's not your on-prem data center. It's a service-driven platform that is great at a ton of things, but it's not an extension of on-prem.
Okay.
And what I found in most of my experiences with the cloud, dating back to my first attempts at ExpressRoute and Azure, is a lot of times the impression that folks in leadership may get about how to handle the cloud.
Oh yeah,
and I think it's our jobs as engineers to try to understand and explain the appropriate use case for each technology, right? And really advocate for that. Otherwise you get into a scenario where you're doing, massive amounts of data replication into a cloud environment that really doesn't need it. And you'll see that egress bill. It is not pretty. Right. So take your time and look at Terraform. It's a great tool, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I love the recommendation to look at those reference architectures, and just get a sense of what a good design looks like. That's one of the ways that I learned over the years in traditional networking, just to see how somebody solved a particular problem in a network diagram, if they had one, or in the various courses. So that's a great recommendation. Thank you. So, Charlie, this has been a great conversation. I would love to have you back one day to talk really a lot more in depth about Geneve, and also with your experience with EVPN, EVPN, VXLAN, BGP, all of that overlay.
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah. I don't get to do enough of it anymore, but really that's where my heart's at. Data center fabrics, I think, are so fascinating, and it's and we're to the point now that cloud adoption has become so prevalent that those two technologies are starting to bleed together a little bit, or starting to have to interoperate, and that brings into some, you know, some really fun architectures. So
yeah,
I would love to chat about it.
Yeah, we'll set it up. So thanks again for joining me, Charlie. And for our audience, if you have an idea for an episode, I'd love to hear from you. You can reach out at telemetrynow@kentik.com. Or if you have an idea for a show, please reach out and we'll have a conversation. So for now, thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.